of bacon, mushrooms still sizzling in butter, and a slice of tomato. Finn veered toward the plate like a compass needle swinging to magnetic north. Doc pulled him back.
"Wait," he said. "No grabbing, my son."
And to Marm,
"I'll take it from here. He'll want you."
Marm nodded, gave Finn a wink, and headed for Mr. Ludlam's study. Doc picked up the plate with its freight of cholesterol-loaded goodies, but as soon as Marm was gone, he put it down again and pulled Finn to the right, away from the pantry in the room beyond.
"Hey," Finn said, "my breakfast."
Doc's hand clamped Finn's elbow hard enough to hurt. He dragged Finn to a door between the sink and the refrigerator. They emerged in an alley. Finn smelled fresh air tanged with gasoline. The black tradesman's van was there, the engine running.
Mr. Weasel was behind the wheel.
When he saw them, he went between the seats into the back. The rear doors flew open.
"Hurry the fuck up," Pando said.
"No fear, he'll be in the Jakes," Doc said.
"Yeah, but he don't stay in there long these days, and he ain't entirely stupid even yet. Get in here, son."
Finn had time for one amazed look at the thin slice of blue sky above the alley, then stumbled into the back of the van. His legs were stiff and he went sprawling, half in and half out. Pando grabbed him and hauled him the rest of the way. From his back pocket he pulled a black hood.
"Put this over your head, no argument. This ain't the time."
Finn pulled the bag over his head. His hands were trembling. One of them, Doc, he thought, shouldered into him and he went down on his arse, head banging the side of the van hard enough to see stars inside the bag. The door slammed shut.
"Go," Doc snarled. "And mind you don't get us into a haccident."
Finn heard Pando return to the driver's seat and the squeak of springs as he sat down. The van started to move. There was a pause at the end of the alley, and then a hard right turn. Doc thumped down beside Finn with a sigh.
"Fuck me for a criminal," he said.
"Well," Finn thought, "what else would you call yourself?"
"Are you taking me somewhere to kill me?"
The idea actually didn't seem so bad, not compared to being face up on the drowning board with a sopping towel across his face. Doc gave a brief grunt of what might have been laughter.
"If I'd wanted you dead, I would have let you eat breakfast. The mushrooms were poisoned."
"What?"
"Poison! Poison! You never heard of it, you thick prat?"
"Where are you?"
"Shut up."
There was a left turn, a right, then some of both as they circled at least two roundabouts. There was a long pause, that a traffic light, Finn assumed, and Pando laid on the horn when the cue didn't move quick enough to suit him.
"Belay that, you numpty," Doc called.
On they went, more lefts and rights. Then the van picked up speed, so they were on a faster road, but Finn didn't hear enough noise to make him believe it was a motorway. Time passed. There was the click of a lighter, then the smell of cigarette smoke.
"He doesn't let us smoke when we're on a job," Doc said.
Finn kept quiet. He was thinking about the poisoned mushrooms, if they had been poisoned. Sometime later, maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20, Doc helped himself to another cigarette and said,
"He thinks he's only lost two, but the rest slipped away last night. Me and Pando were the last, except for Marm. Marm won't leave him."
From up front, Pando said,
"Marm's as crazy as he is."
"We risked our lives to bring you out, Finn," Doc said. "I don't expect thanks, but we did."
Finn thanked him anyway. His voice was trembling, and his legs were shaking. "Shake, shake, sugar, but you never shake me," he thought. That was Elvis. "Stuck on you." Finn wondered if his grandma knew Elvis had gobbled up his twin brother Enos.
"Thank you so much." "I don't know if you're worth a sight to anyone, but you don't deserve to die just because he is the way he is now. Did you see that pamphlet he's so proud of? Wrote it himself, didn't he? But he wasn't always that way. No. We did good work once upon a time, didn't we, Pando?"
"Saved a fucking world in 17, Pando said, "and not more than a dozen people ever knew. But we knew, kid. We did.
Feeney's up to something, Doc said. That much I never doubted. You weren't a part of it, but he wouldn't let it go, even though he don't remember squat.
Is it?
Shut up, Doc said. Just be a good little laddie and keep your goddamn mouth shut, unless you want to get into worse trouble.
From the front, Pando said,
No, he wasn't always this way.
I remember.
Ah, never mind. For half a crown, I'd put a bullet in your goddamned head myself.
2 hours later, at least two, they came into another town. A biggish one from the sound of the cars and lorries and the voices Finn heard at stoplights. Voices and laughter, the sound foreign to him. At last the van pulled up and Doc yanked the bag from Finn's head.
This is your stop, son, and this is for your trouble.
He stuffed something into the front pocket of Finn's jeans. Then suddenly, Doc didn't seem to know he was going to do it until it was done. He kissed Finn on the forehead.
Keep me in your prayers. I'll need a fucking lot of them.
He opened the back doors. Finn's step stumbled out. The van pulled away while Doc was still yanking the doors shut. Finn looked around like a man waking from a vivid dream. A bicyclist rang a bell and called, Left, on your left! Finn stepped up onto the curb to keep from being hit broadside by an old buffer with a white mustache and a nose like the prow of a destroyer. To his right was the Randolph Street newsagents, where he bought Grandma's word search books, and sometimes, if he was feeling generous, an okay or a heat for his sisters. Next to it was the Your Best Chippy. Finn hadn't spent half a fortune in there over the last 10 years. He was less than a mile from home. He walked that way slowly, looking around, meeting the eyes of other pedestrians. Most looked away at once, surely believing they were crossing gazes with a crazy street person, looking at the sky, looking in every window. I'm alive, he thought. Alive. 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 He also looked over his shoulder several times, making sure there was no sign of the black tradesman's man. He stopped at the corner of Peak Street and peered around to make sure Bobby Feeney wasn't running toward him on a collision course, bearing away the secret papers or the blueprints or heading for the bomb factory. No one was there. He reached into his pocket and brought out a wad of banknotes, green euros, 40 or more. He stuffed the wad back into his pocket. For every stroke of bad luck, 2 strokes. Of the good, Grandma had said. Well, he had at least 4,000. That was 1 stroke. And he had his life. That was another. Home was only 2 blocks down and 1 street over. They would be worried about him. For all he knew, his mother had flown home early from her big business thingy, but they could wait a little longer. He turned back along Peak Street to Emberley. Then from Emberley to Jane Street. Halfway down Jane was Pettingill Park. It must have been early afternoon of a school day, because the playground was empty, except for 2 toddlers on the roundy-round who were circling slowly, pushed by either their mother or their minder. Finn sat on a bench. He looked at the twisty, and a terrible memory came to him. In his last year of school, Mr. Edgerton assigned them a story by Ambrose Bierce. After they had all read it, presumably not all of Finn's classmates were of the reading class, Mr. Edgerton showed them a short film based on the story, which was about the hanging of a slave owner in the American Civil War. The slave owner is pushed off a bridge, but the rope breaks and he swims to safety. The twist is this. The fortuitous escape was all in his mind, a kind of mini-dream before he's actually pushed from the bridge and executed. That could be happening to me, Finn thought. They went too far with the waterboarding and I'm drowning. Only instead of my whole life flashing in front of my eyes as it's supposed to do, I'm imagining that Doc took me out. Pando drove us away, and here I am.
in the park I enjoyed so much as a wee lad. Because really, is my escape likely? Is it realistic? You might believe it in a story, but in real life, was it real life, though? Was it? Finn seized one of his cheeks, still tender from slaps administered by Doc before Doc's unlikely change of heart. He twisted it hard. It hurt, and for a moment, Pettingill Park seemed to waver like a mirage. That was caused by tears of pain, though. Wasn't it? Nor was it just Doc's change of heart that was bizarre. Mr. Ludlam, who used to be Mr. Dayton? The badly printed pamphlet, and badly spelled, don't forget that. The business about Elvis's twin brother? Wasn't that all the stuff of dreams? What if Bobby Feeney hadn't just knocked him on his arse, but on his noggin? What if Finn had hit said noggin on the exact same place where it had once been cracked on the memorable, not that he actually did remember, day when he had been brushed by lightning? Wouldn't that just be Finn Murray's luck? What if he was lying in a hospital bed somewhere, deep in a coma, his damaged brain creating some crackpot alternate reality? Finn got up and walked slowly to the twisty. He hadn't climbed its curves in years, not since he was knee-high to a grasshopper, as Grandma would say. He climbed it now, pulling himself along by the raised sides. It was a tight fit, but he managed. The mom, her childminder, had stopped pushing the kids on the roundy-round. She shaded her eyes with her hands and said, "What in heaven's name are you about? You'll break it, you great galoot." Finn didn't reply, and he didn't break it. He reached the top, turned himself around, and sat with his legs on the first curve. He thought, "Either I'll still be here when I get to the bottom, or I won't be." Simple as that. He looked at the woman and said, "Elvis has left the building." Then he pushed off. On Slide Inn Road. Grandpop's dinosaur of a Buick creeps along the dirt road at 20 miles an hour. Frank Brown is driving with his eyes slitted and his mouth compressed to a fine white line. Corrine, his missus, is riding shotgun with her iPad open in her lap, and when Frank asks her if she's sure this is right, she tells him everything is fine, steady as she goes. They'll rejoin the main road in another 6 miles, 8 at most, and from there it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to the turnpike. She doesn't want to say that the blinking blue dot marking their location disappeared 5 minutes ago and the map is frozen in place. They've been married 14 years, and Corrine knows the mouth her husband is currently wearing. It means he's close to blowing his stack. In the spacious back seat, Billy Brown and Mary Brown sit flanking Grandpop, who has his big old black shoes planted on either side of the drive shaft hump. Billy is 11. Mary is 9. Grandpop is 75. A giant pain in the ass as far as his son is concerned, and too old to have such young grandchildren, but there it is. When they set out from Falmouth to see Grandpop's dying sister up in Derry, Grandpop talked nonstop, mostly about the zipper bag in the back seat. It contains Nan's baseball souvenirs. "Mad about baseball, she was," he tells them. There are baseball cards that he says are worth a fortune. Frank Brown fucking doubts this. Her college softball gloves signed by Dom DiMaggio, and the prize of all prizes, a Louisville slugger signed by Ted Williams. She won it in a Jimmy Fund charity raffle the year before the Splendid Splinter called it quits. "Teddy ball game flew in Korea, you know," Grandpop tells the kids. "Bombed hell out of the gooks." Not a word the children need to know,
Corrine said from the front seat, but without much thought of success. Her father-in-law grew up in a politically incorrect age, and he's carried it with him. She also thought of asking him what a dying semi-comatose octogenarian was supposed to do with a bat and glove, but kept still on that point, too. Donald Brown has never had much to say about his sister, good or bad, but he must feel something for her, or he wouldn't have insisted they make this trip. He insisted on his old Buick, too, because it's roomy and because he said he knew a shortcut that might be a little rough. He's right on both counts. He also tucked a pile of his old comic books into the bag.
"Reading material for the youngsters on the trip," he said.
Billy doesn't give shit one for old comic books. He's playing a game on his phone. But Mary got on her knees, unzipped Grandpop's bag, and grabbed a stack. Most are cruddy, but some are pretty good. In the one she's reading now, Betty and Veronica are fighting over Archie, pulling each other's hair and such.
"You know what? Back in the old days, you could go down to Fenway on $3 gas," Grandpop says. "And you could go to the game, snag a hot dog and a beer."
"And still get change back from a five spot," Frank mutters from behind the wheel.
"That's right," Grandpop shouts. "Damn straight you could. First game I ever saw with my sis, Ellis Kinder was pitching and Hoot Evers was in center field. My, that boy could hit. He knocked one over the right field fence and Nan spilled her popcorn. She was cheering so hard."
Billy Brown also gives shit one about baseball. "Grandpop, why do you like to sit in the middle like that? You have to spread your legs."
"I'm giving my balls an airing," Grandpop says.
"What balls?" Mary asks and frowns when Billy sniggers. Corrine looks back over her shoulder. "That's enough of that, Grandpop," she says. "We're taking you to see your sister, and we're going in your old car as you requested, so..." "And it gobbles gas like you wouldn't believe," Frank says. Corrine ignores this. She has her eyes on the prize. "It's a favor, so do me one and keep the nasty talk to yourself." Grandpop says he will, sorry, then bears his dentures at her in a leer that says he'll do just about whatever the fuck he wants.
"What balls?" Mary persists.
"Baseballs," Billy says. "Grandpop's got baseball on the brain. Just read your funny book and shut up. Don't distract me. I've made it to level 5.
"If Nan had been born with balls, she could have played pro," Grandpop says. "That bitch was good."
"Donald," Corrine Brown nearly shouts. "Enough."
"Well, she was," the old man says sulkily. "Played varsity softball on the University of Maine team that went to the Women's World Series all the way to Oklahoma City and almost got sucked up by a tornado."
Frank doesn't contribute to the conversation, only peers ahead at the road he never should have gone down and thanks God he didn't overrule his father and take the Volvo. Is the road getting narrower? He believes it is. Is it getting rougher? He knows it is. Even the name strikes Frank as ominous. Who calls a road, even a piece of shit like this one, Slide In Road? Grandpop said it was a shortcut to Highway 196, and Corrine agreed after consulting her iPad. And although Frank is no fan of shortcuts, as a banker he knows they usually lead to trouble, he is initially seduced by the smooth black tar. Soon enough, however, tar gave way to dirt, and a mile or two later, the dirt gave way to rutted hardpan lined on both sides by high weeds, goldenrod, and staring sunflowers. They go over a washboard that causes the Buick to shake like a dog after a bath. He wouldn't care if the high-mileage, gas-guzzling, overweening piece of Detroit stupidity shook itself to death, were it not for the possibility of being broken down out here in East Jesus. And now, dear God, a plugged culvert has washed out half the road, and Mr. Brown has to creep around it on the left, the tires on his side barely skirting the ditch. If there had been room to turn around, he would have said the hell with this and gone back, but there is no room. They make it. Barely. "How far now?" he asks Corrine.
About 5 miles.
With MapQuest frozen, she has no idea, but she has a hopeful heart. Which is a good thing.
She discovered years ago that marriage to Frank and motherhood to Billy and Mary weren't what she had expected, and now, as a shitty bonus, they have this unpleasant old man living with them because they can't afford to put him in a retirement home. Hope is getting her through. They are going to see an old lady dying of cancer, but Corrine Brown hopes someday to go on a carnival cruise and drink something with a paper umbrella in it. She hopes to have a richer, fuller life when the kids finally grow up and go out on their own. She would also like to fuck a lifeguard with muscles, a tan, and a dazzling grin full of white teeth, but understands the difference between hope and fantasy. "Grandpa," Mary says, "why do they call it the slide-in road? Who slid in?"
"It's in with two ends," Grandpa says. "There used to be a fine one out here, even had a golf course, but it burned flat. Road's gotten bad since the last time I drove it. Used to be as smooth as a baby's bottom."
"When was that, Dad?" Frank asks. "When Ted Williams was still playing for the Red Sox? Because it sure isn't up to much now." They hit a big pothole. The Buick jounces. Frank grits his teeth.
"Whoops, my dear!"
Grandpop cries, and when Billy asks him what that means, Grandpop tells him it's what you say when you go over a bump like that.
"Isn't it, Frank? We used to say that all the time, didn't we?"
Mr. Brown doesn't answer.
"Didn't we?"
Frank doesn't answer. His knuckles are white on the steering wheel.
"Didn't we?"
"Yeah, Dad. Whoops, my fucking dear." "Frank," Corrine says in a chiding tone. Mary giggles. Billy snickers. Grandpop bares his dentures in another leer. We're having such fun, Frank thinks. Gee, if this trip could only last longer. If only it could last forever. The trouble with the old bastard, Corrine thinks, is that he still gets a kick out of life, and people who get a kick out of life take a long time kicking the bucket. They like that old bucket. Billy returns to his game. He's reached level 6. He has yet to make it to level 7.
"Billy," Frank says, "have you got bars on your phone?"
Billy pauses the game and checks.
"One, but it keeps flickering on and off."
"Great. Terrific." Another washboard shivers through the Buick and Frank slows to 15. He wonders if he could change his name, ditch his family, and get a job at some little bank in an Australian town. Learn to call people mate and say, "Good day."
"Look at kids," Grandpop bawls.
He's leaning forward and from this position is able to overload both his son's right ear and his daughter-in-law's left. They wince away in opposite directions, not just from the noise, but from his breath. It smells like a small animal died in his mouth, shitting as it expired. He starts most mornings burping up bile and smacking his lips afterward, as if it's tasty. Whatever's going on inside him can't be good, and yet he exudes that horrible vitality. "Sometimes," Corrine thinks, "I believe I could kill him. I really do. Only I think the kids love him. Christ knows why, but they do."
"Look at there! Right over there!"
One arthritis-bunched finger stabs out between Mr. and Mrs. Brown. The horny talon at the tip almost rips into Mrs. Brown's cheek.
"That's the old slide-in. What's left of it? Right there! I've been there once, you know. Me and my sister Nan and our folks, we had breakfast in our rooms."
The kids look dutifully at what remains of the slide-in. A few charred beams and a cellar hole. Mrs. Brown sees an old panel truck up there, parked in the weeds and sunflowers. It looks even older than Grandpop's Buick, the sides caked with rust.
"Cool, Grandpop," Billy says, and once more returns to his game.
"Cool, Grandpop,"
Mary says, and goes back to her funny book. The ruin of the hotel slips behind them. Frank wonders if perhaps the owners burned it down on purpose, for the insurance money. Because really, who would want to come out here to spend a weekend or, God forbid, a honeymoon?
Maine has plenty of beauty spots, but this isn't one of them. This isn't even a place you go through to get to somewhere else unless you can't avoid it. And they could have. That's the hair across his ass.
What if Great Aunt Nan dies before we get there, Grandpa? Mary asks. She's finished her comic book. The next one is Little Lulu, and she has no interest. Little Lulu looks like a turd in a dress.
Well, then, we'll turn around and go back, Grandpa says. After the funeral, of course.
The funeral. Oh, God, the funeral. Frank hasn't even thought about how she could be dead already. She might even pop off while they're visiting, and then they would have to stay for the old bird's funeral. He's only brought a single change of clothes, and...
Look out! Corrine shouts. Stop!
Frank does, and just in time. There's another plugged culvert and another washout at the top of the hill. Only this washout goes all the way across. The crevasse looks at least 3 feet wide. God knows how deep it is.
What's wrong, Dad?
Billy asks, pausing his game again.
What's wrong, Dad?
Mary asks, stopping her search for another Archie funny book.
What's wrong, Frankie?
Grandpop asks. For a moment, Frank Brown only sits with his hands at 10 and 2 on the Buick steering wheel, staring over the Buick's long hood. They knew how to make 'em back in the old days, his father sometimes likes to opine. Those, of course, being the same old days when a self-respecting woman wouldn't go shopping without first cinching on a girdle and hooking up her stockings to a garter belt. The days when gay people went in fear of their lives and there was a penny candy called nigger babies available at every 5 and dime. Nothing like the old days, yes, sir. Well, fuck your fucking shortcut, he says. You see where it's gotten us.
Frank, Corrine starts, but he gets out before she can finish and stands staring at the place where the road is cracked open.
Billy leans over Grandpop's lap to whisper in his sister's ear. Fuck your fucking shortcut. She puts her hands over her mouth and snickers. That's good. Grandpop chuckles, which is even better. There are reasons why they love him. Corrine gets out and joins her husband in front of the Buick's sneery grill. She looks into the deep crack in the road and sees nothing good.
What do you think we should do?
The kids join them. Mary on her mother's side and Billy on his father's. Then Grandpop comes shuffling along in his big black shoes, looking cheerful. I don't know, Frank says, but we're sure not going this way.
Got to back up, Grandpop says. Back all the way down to the good old slide in. You can turn around in the driveway. No chain.
Jesus, Frank says, and runs his hands through his thinning hair. All right. When we get to the main road, we can decide whether to keep going to Derry or just head home. Grandpop looks outraged at the idea of retreat, but after scanning his son's face, especially the red spots on his cheeks and the red line dashed across his forehead, he keeps his trap shut.
Everybody back in, Frank says. But this time you sit on one side or the other, Dad, so I can see where I'm going without your head in the way.
If we had the Volvo, he thinks, I could use the backup camera. Instead, we've got this oversized piece of stupidity.
I'll walk, Grandpop says. It's not but 200 yards.
Me too,
Mary says, and Billy seconds that.
Fine, Frank says. Try not to fall down and break your leg, Dad. That would be the final touch to an absolutely wonderful day.
Grandpop and the kids start back down the hill to the burned-out inn's driveway, Mary and Billy holding the old man's hands. Frank thinks it could be a Norman Rockwell painting, and a stinky old bastard shall eat them. He gets behind the Buick steering wheel. Corrine gets in the passenger seat. She puts a hand on his arm and gives him her sweetest smile, the one that says, I love you, you big strong man. Frank isn't big. He's not particularly strong, and there's not much bloom left on the rose of their marriage. A bit wilted, that rose. Petals going brown at the edges, but she needs to soothe him out of the red zone, and long experience has taught her how to do it. He sighs and puts the Buick in reverse. Try not to run them down, she says, looking back over her shoulder. Don't tempt me, Frank says,
and begins to creep the Buick backward. The ditches are deep on either side of this narrow track, and if he drops the rear end into one of them, it will be Katie bar the door. Grandpop and the kids reach the driveway before Frank is even halfway down the hill. The old man can see tracks pressed into the weeds. That panel truck looks like it's been there for years, but Grandpop guesses that's not the case. Maybe someone decided to camp for a few days. It's the only thing he can think of. There sure can't be anything up there left to scavenge. Any fool could see that. Donald Brown loves his son, and there are many things Frankie can do well, although Grandpop can't think of any right off the top of his head. But when it comes to backing up that Buick estate wagon, he isn't worth a dry popcorn fart. The rear end is wagging from side to side like the tail of an old tired dog. He almost dumps it in the left ditch, overcorrects, almost dumps it in the right one, and overcorrects again.
Boy, he's not doing that very good, Billy says.
Hush up, Grandpop says. He's doing fine.
Can me and Mary go up and look at the old slip in?
Slide in, Grandpop says.
Sure, go on up for a minute. Run, and be ready to come back down. Your dad's not in a very good temper.
The kids run up the overgrown drive.
Don't fall in the cellar hole,
Grandpop bawls after them, and is about to add that they should stay in sight, but before he can do it, there's a crunch, an abbreviated honk of the horn, and then his son cursing a blue streak. There, that's one of the things he's good at. Grandpop turns from the scampering kids to see that, after managing to back all the way down the hill without going off the road, Frank's ditched the wagon while trying to make a three-point turn.
Shut up, Frankie, Grandpop shouts. Quit that cussing. Turn off the motor before you stall it out.
He's probably torn off half the tailpipe anyway, but there's no point telling him that. Frank shuts off the motor and gets out. Corrine gets out too, but it's a struggle. She tears an arc of weeds ahead of the door and finally manages. The car's rear end is bumper deep on the right side, and the front is angled upward on the left. Frank walks to his father. The ground gave way while I was turning.
You cut it too tight, the old man says. That's why only your right side back wheel went in.
The ground gave way, I'm telling you.
Cut it too tight. It gave way, goddammit.
Standing side by side as they are, Corrine sees how much they look alike, and although she's seen the resemblance many times before, on this beshitted summer morning it comes as a revelation. She realizes that her husband is on time's conveyor belt, and before it dumps him off into the boneyard, he will actually become his father, only without Grandpop's sour but occasionally engaging sense of humor.
Sometimes she gets so tired. Of Frank, yes, but also of herself. Because is she any better? She'd like to think so, but really doesn't believe it. She looks around where Billy and Mary were, then at Grandpop. Donald, where are the kids?
The kids are inspecting the panel truck at the top of the hill, close to where the slide-in once stood. The tire on the driver's side is flat. While Mary goes around the front to look at the license plate, she's always on the lookout for new ones, a game Grandpop taught her. Billy walks to the edge of the long hole in the ground where the inn once stood. He looks down and sees it's full of dark water. Charred beams stick up, and a woman's leg. The foot is clad in a bright blue sneaker. He stares, at first frozen, then backs away.
Billy, Mary calls, it's a Delaware, my first Delaware.
That's right, sweetie, someone says. Delaware it is.
Billy looks up. Two men are walking around the far end of the foundation hall. They are young. One is tall, with red hair that's all oily and clumpy. He has a lot of pimples. The other one is short and fat. He's got a bag in one hand that looks like Grandpop's old bowling bag, the one with Rolling Thunder on the side and fading blue letters. This one has no writing on it. Both men are smiling. Billy tries to smile back. He doesn't know if it really looks like a smile or more like a kid trying not to scream, but he hopes it's a smile. He doesn't want these two men to know he was looking into the cellar hole. Mary comes around the side of the little white truck with its flat shoe. Her smile looks completely natural. Sure, why not? She's a little girl, and as far as she knows, everybody likes little girls.
Hi, she says. I'm Mary. That's my brother Billy. Our car went in the ditch.
She points down the hill at where her father and grandpop are looking at the back end of the Buick and her mother is looking up at them.
Well, hi there, Mary, says the redhead. Good to meet you.
You too, Billy. The fat young man drops a hand on Billy's shoulder. The touch is startling, but Billy is too scared to jump. He holds onto his smile with all his might.
Yep, a little problem there, the fat young man says, peering down.
And when Corrine raises one hand, tentatively, the fat one raises his in return.
Think we could help, Galen? I bet we could, says the redhead. We've got our own problems, as you see.
And he points to the flat tire.
No spare.
He bends down to Billy. His eyes are bright blue. There doesn't seem to be anything in them.
Did you check out that hole, Billy? Mighty big one.
No, Billy says. He's trying to sound natural, unconcerned by the question, but doesn't know if he's getting that in his voice or not. He thinks he might faint. He wishes, God, he wishes that he never looked down there. Blue sneaker. I was afraid I might fall in.
Smart kid, Galen says. Isn't he, Pete?
Smart,
the fat one agrees and tosses Corrine another wave. Grandpop is now looking up the hill, too. Frank is still staring at the Buick's ditched rear end, shoulders slumped.
That skinny one, your dad?
Red-headed Galen asks Mary.
Yep, and that's our grandpop. He's old.
No shit, Sherlock,
Pete says. His hand is still on Billy's shoulder. Billy looks down at it and sees what might be blood under the nail of Pete's second finger.
Well, you know what?
Galen says. He's leaning down, speaking to Mary, who's smiling up at him.
I bet we could push that big old sumbitch right out of there. Then maybe your dad could give us a ride to some place where there's a garage. Get a new tire for our little truck.
Are you from Delaware?
Mary asks.
Well, we've been through there, Pete says.
Then he and Galen exchange a look and they laugh.
Well, let's take a look at that car of yours, Galen says. Want me to carry you down, sweetie?
No, that's okay, Mary says, her smile growing slightly tentative. I can walk.
Your bro don't talk much, does he?
Pete says. His hand, the one not holding the bowling bag, if that's what it is still on Billy's shoulder.
Usually you can't keep him quiet, Mary says. His tongue is hung in the middle and runs at both ends. That's what Grandpop says.
Well, maybe he saw something that scared him quiet, Galen says. Woodchuck?
Or fox? Or something else? I didn't see anything, Billy says. He thinks he might start crying and tells himself he can't. He can't.
Well, come on,
Galen says. He takes Mary's hand. This she allows, and they start down the overgrown driveway. Pete walks beside Billy with his hand still on Billy's shoulder. It's not gripping, but Billy has an idea it would grip if he tried to run. He's pretty sure the men saw him looking into that water-filled cellar hole. He has an idea they are in bad trouble here.
Hey, guys. Hello, ma'am.
Galen sounds as cheerful as a day in July.
Looks like you got a little trouble here. Want a hand?
Oh, that would be wonderful, Corrine says.
Terrific, Frank says. Damn road went out from under the car while I was turning around.
Cut it too tight,
Grandpop says. Frank gives him an ugly look, then turns back to the newcomers and gets up a grin.
I bet with you two men we could push it right out of there.
No doubt, says Pete.
Frank holds out his hand.
Frank Brown. This is my wife Corrine and my father Donald.
Pete Smith, says the fat young man.
Galen Prentice, says the redhead.
Their handshakes all around. Grandpop mutters,
meet ya,
but hardly gives them a glance. He's looking at Billy.
Ma'am, Galen says, why don't you take the wheel?
Me and Pete and your handsome hubby here can push while you steer.
Oh, I don't know, Corrine says.
I could do it, Grandpa says. It's my car, from back in the old days. They really knew how to make 'em back then.
He sounds sulky, and Billy's heart, which had risen a little, now sinks. He thought Grandpop might have an idea about these men, but now guesses he doesn't.
Gramps, I need you to do the heavy looking on. I'm sure Frank's missus can do the driving, can't you?
I suppose. Corrine trails off.
Galen gives her a thumbs up.
Sure you can. Kids, you stand aside with your Gramps.
He's Grandpop, Mary says, not Gramps.
Galen grins.
Why, sure, he says. Grandpop it is. Grandpop goes the weasel.
Corrine gets behind the wheel of the Buick and adjusts the seat forward. Billy can't stop thinking of that leg sticking up out of the murky water in the cellar hall. The blue sneaker. Galen and Pete take spots on the left and right of the Buick's canted rear deck. Frank is in the middle.
Start her up, missus,
Galen calls, and when she does, the three men lean forward, brace their feet, and place their hands on the station wagon's flat back.
Okay, give it some gas. Not a lot, just easy.
The motor revs. Grandpop bends toward Billy. His breath is as sour as ever, but it's Grandpop's breath, and Billy doesn't mind.
What's wrong, kiddo?
Dead lady, Billy whispers back, and now the tears come.
Dead lady in that hole up there.
Little more, Fat Pete yells. Goose the bitch!
Corrine gives it more gas, and the men push. The Buick's rear tires start to spin, then take hold. The estate wagon comes up onto the road.
Whoa, whoa, whoa,
Galen shouts. Billy has a sudden confused wish that his mother would just drive away and leave them, that she would go and be safe. But she stops, puts the Buick in park, and gets out holding down the hem of her dress with the heel of her palm.
Easy peasy, Japanesey, Galen cries.
Back on the road and good as new, only we've still got a little problem, don't we, Pete?
Sure do, Pete says. Flat tire on our truck and no spare. Picked up a nail when we drove up there, I guess.
He puffs out his stubbled cheeks, now shiny with sweat, and makes a flat tire sound. Push! He put his bag down to push, but now he picks it up and unzips it.
Damn, Frank says. No spare, huh?
Don't that suck,
Galen says.
What were you doing up there? Corrine asks. She's left the Buick running, the door open. She looks at her husband, who's smiling his big banker's smile, then at her two children. Her girl looks okay, but Billy's face is white as wax.
Camping, Pete says.
His hand has disappeared into his bag that isn't a bowling bag.
Huh, Frank says. That's...
He doesn't finish. Maybe doesn't know how. And no one seems to know how to start the conversation going again. Birds sing in the trees. Crickets rub their reedy legs in the high weeds, which is the universe they know. The seven people stand in a loose circle behind the idling Buick. Frank and Corrine exchange a look that asks, what's going on here?
Grandpop knows. He saw men like this in Vietnam. Scavengers and skedaddlers. One got stood up against a board fence and was shot by one of his own men after the Tet Offensive wound down. A clusterfuck the grandchildren he's too old to have will probably never read about in their history books. Frank, meanwhile, jerks to life like a wind-up toy.
His "your loan is approved" smile reappears. He takes his wallet from his back pocket.
I wish we could take you to a garage or something, but I've got a full car, as you see.
Your missus could sit on my lap, Pete says and waggles his eyebrows.
Frank chooses to ignore this.
But tell you what, we'll stop and send someone back first place we see. In the meantime, how does 10 apiece sound for helping us out?
He opens the wallet. Very gently, Galen plucks it from his hand. Frank doesn't try to stop him. He just stares at his hands, wide-eyed, as if the wallet is still there. As if he can still feel its weight, but now it's invisible.
Why don't I just take all of it? Galen says.
Give that back, Corrine says. She feels Mary's hand creep into hers, and she folds her own fingers over it. That's not yours.
Is now.
His voice is as gentle as the hand that took the wallet. Let's see what we got here. He opens it. Frank takes a step forward. Pete takes his hand out of his not-a-bowling bag. There's a revolver in it. Looks like a .38 to Grandpa.
Stand back, Frankie Wanky, Pete says. We're doing business here.
Galen removes a small sheaf of bills from the wallet. He folds them over, puts them in the pocket of his jeans, then tosses the wallet to Pete, who puts it in the bag.
Gramps, let's have yours.
Outlaws, Grandpop says. That's what you are.
That's right, Galen agrees in his gentle voice. And if you don't want me to go upside this boy's head, give me your wallet.
That does it for Billy. His bladder lets go and his crotch gets warm. He starts to cry, partly out of shame and partly from fear.
Grandpop digs his old scarred Lord Buxton from the front left pocket of his baggy pants and hands it over. It's bulging, but mostly with cards, photos, and receipts going back 5 or more years. Galen pulls out a 20 and a few ones, stuffs them in his pocket, and tosses the Lord Buxton to Pete. Into the bag it goes.
I had to clean it out once in a while, Grampy, Galen says. That's one slutty billfold.
Says the man who looks like he washed his hair last Thanksgiving, Grandpop says,
and quick as a snake striking out of a bush, Galen slaps him across the face.
Mary bursts into tears and puts her face against her mother's hip.
Stop that, Frank says, as if the thing is not already done and his father bleeding from lip and nostril. Then in the same breath, shut up, Dad.
I don't let folks sass me, Galen says. Not even old men. Old men should especially know better. Now, Corrine, let's get your purse out of your car. Your little girl can come with us.
He takes Mary by the arm, the pads of his fingers sinking into her scant flesh. Let her alone, Corrine says.
You're not in charge here, Galen says. Tell me what to do again and I'll change your face.
Pete, make Frank and his father stand together, shoulders touching. And if either of them moves...
Pete gestures with the revolver. Grandpop shuffles next to his son. Frank is breathing through his nose in quick little snorts. Grandpop wouldn't be surprised if he passed out.
You saw, didn't you? Pete asks Billy. Fess up.
I didn't see anything, Billy says through his tears, blubbing like a baby and can't help it.
Blue sneaker?
Liar, liar, pants on fire, Pete says.
He laughs and ruffles the boy's hair. Galen comes back folding more bills into his pocket. He's let go of Mary. The girl is now clinging to her mother.
Corrine looks dazed.
Grandpop doesn't waste time looking at his people. He's watching Galen rejoin Pete, needing to see what passes between them, and he sees pretty much what he expected. And no sense pretending otherwise. They can take the Buick and leave the Brown family, or they can take the Buick and kill the Brown family. If caught, these two will get life in the shank no matter what kind of score they run up.
There's more, Grandpop says.
What's that?
Galen asks. He's the talker. His fellow outlaw seems to be the fat, silent type.
More money. Quite a bit. I'll give it to you if you let us be. Just take the wagon and let us be.
How much more?
Galen asks.
Can't say for sure, but I put it around 3,300. It's in my go-bag.
Why would an old fuck like you be driving around the Willy-Wags with 3,000 and change?
Because of my sister Nan. We were going up to Derry to see her before she passes away. Won't be long, if it hasn't happened already. She's got the cancer. It's all through her.
Pete has put his not-a-bowling bag down again. Now he rubs two of his fingers together and says,
This is the world's smallest violin playing My Heart Pumps Purple Piss for You.
Grandpop pays no attention.
I cashed out most of my Social Security to pay for the funeral. Nan hasn't got squat, and they give you a discount if you pay cash.
He pats Billy's shoulder.
This boy looked it all up for me on the internet.
Billy did no such thing, but except for another chest-hitching sob or two, he keeps quiet. He wishes he and Mary had never gone up to the Slide Inn. And when he looks at his father through blurry eyes, he feels a moment of bright hate. It's your fault, Dad, he thinks. You ditched the car, and these men stole our money, and now they're going to kill us. Grandpop knows. I can see he does.
Where's your go bag? Galen asks.
And back with the rest of the luggage.
Get it.
Grandpop goes to the Buick. He gives a grunt as he raises the trunk lid. That's his back trying to cramp up.
Back goes first, pecker goes last, everything else in between, his own father used to say. The bag is just like Pete's, with a zipper along the top, except it's longer, more like a duffel bag than a bowling bag. He runs the zipper and spreads the bag open.
No gun in there, Gramps, is there? Galen asks.
No, no, that's for boys like you. But look at this.
Grandpop brings out a battered old softball glove.
The sister I was telling you about? This was hers. I brought it for her to look at if she hasn't passed on yet, or in a coma. She wore it in the Women's World Series out in Okie City. Softball, you know. Played shortstop. Before the Second World War, if you can believe it. And look at this.
He turns the glove over.
Gramps, Galen says, all due respect, but I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, but here, on the back,
Grandpop persists.
See it? Signed by Dom DiMaggio, Jolton Joe's brother, you know.
He tosses the glove aside and burrows into the bag again.
Got about 200 baseball cards, some signed and worth money.
Pete grabs Billy's arm and twists it. Billy screams. Don't, Corrine screams back. Don't hurt my boy. It's your boy's fault you're in this mess, Pete says. Snoopy little brat. Then to Grandpop. We don't want no fucking baseball cards. Mary is crying. Corrine is crying. Billy sees his dad looking ready to pass out, and Grandpop doesn't seem to care about any of them. Grandpop has retreated into his own world.
What about funny books?
He says. He brings out a handful and brandishes them.
The Archies and Caspers wouldn't fetch nothing. But here's a few old Supermans, and a Batman or two. One where he fights the Joker.
I think I'm going to tell Pete to shoot your son if you don't stop stalling, Galen says. Is the money there or not?
Yeah, yeah, Grandpop says. Down at the bottom. But I got something else that might interest you.
I'm all done being interested, Galen says. He steps forward. I'll just get the money myself, if it's there at all. Get out of my way.
Oh, wake up, Grandpop says. This would fetch twice what I got for cash.
He brings out the Louisville Slugger.
Signed by Ted Williams, the splendid splinter himself. Put it on eBay. It'd fetch 7,000. Seven at least.
How did your sis come by it? Galen asks, interested at last. He can see the signature, faded but legible on the barrel.
Just gave him a smile and a wink when he came down Autograph Alley,
Grandpop says and swings the bat. It connects with Galen's temple. His scalp pops open like a window shade. Blood flies up. His eyes squeeze shut in pain and surprise. He staggers, one hand out and flailing, trying to keep his balance.
Get the other one, Frankie, Grandpop shouts. Take him down.
Frank doesn't move, just stands there with his mouth open. Pete stares at Galen, for a precious moment completely stunned, but the moment passes. He turns the gun toward Grandpop. Billy springs at him.
No, Corrine shouts. Billy, no!
Billy grabs Pete's arm, bringing it down, and when Pete fires the gun, the slug goes into the ground between his feet. Galen straightens, one hand clutching the station wagon's raised trunk lid. Grandpop winds up, ignoring a howl of protest from his back, and hits the redhead in the ribs with 33 ounces of solid Kentucky ash. Galen's knees buckle, and his gasp,
Pete, shoot this fucker,
is hardly more than a whisper. Grandpop raises the bat. There's another shot,
but he's not hit. At least he doesn't think so. And he brings the bat down on Galen's lowered head. Galen falls face first into one of the Buick wagon's tire treads. Pete tries to shake Billy off, but Billy holds on like a ferret, his eyes bulging and his teeth digging into his lower lip. The gun waves here and there and goes off a third time, sending a bullet into the sky. "Now, you mother hump!" Grandpop snarls. Pete at last flings Billy away, but before he can raise the gun, Grandpop brings the bat down on his wrist, breaking it. The gun drops onto the ground. Pete turns and runs, leaving his not-a-bowling-bag on the ground. The two children fling themselves at Grandpop, hugging him and almost knocking him over. He pushes them away. His old heart is hammering, and if it just gave out, he wouldn't be a bit surprised. "Billy, get the fat one's bag. Our goods are in it, and I don't think I can bend over." The boy doesn't. Maybe the gunshots deafened him a little, but the girl does. She throws the bag into the back of the Buick and then rubs her hands on the front of her unicorn tee. "Frank," Grandpop says, "is that red-haired boy dead?" Frank doesn't move, but Corrine kneels next to Galen. After several seconds, she looks up, her eyes very blue under her pale forehead. He's not breathing.
"Well, that's no great loss to the world," Grandpop says. "Billy, get that gun. Keep your hands away from the trigger."
Billy picks up the fallen revolver. He holds it out to his father, but Frank only looks at it. Grandpop takes it and puts it in the pocket where his wallet was. Frank just stands there, looking at Galen, lying face down in the weeds with the top of his head stove in.
"Grandpop! Grandpop!" Billy says, tugging the old man's arm. His mouth is trembling. Tears are streaming down his cheeks and snot lathers his upper lip. "What if the fat one has another gun in their little truck?"
"What if we just get the hell out of here?" Grandpop says. "Corrine, you drive. I can't. Kids, get in back."
He's not even sure he can sit. He's fucked up his back most righteously, but he'll have to do it no matter how much it hurts. Corrine closes the trunk. The kids take one more look up the overgrown driveway to see if Pete is coming back. Then they run for the wagon. Grandpop goes to his son.
"You had a chance and just stood there. You could have got me killed. Got all of us killed."
Grandpop slaps Frank across the face just as he, Grandpop, was slapped by the man who now lies dead at their feet.
"Get in, son. Maybe you're too old to help what you are. I don't know."
Frank walks to the front passenger side like a man in a dream and gets in. Grandpop opens the door behind him and finds he can't bend down, so he falls backward onto the seat, pulling his legs in after him with little whimpers of pain. Mary crawls over him to close the door, and that hurts too. It's not just his back. Feels like he busted his gut.
"Grandpop, are you all right?" Corrine asks. She's looking back. Frank is staring straight ahead through the windshield. His hands are on his knees.
"I'm all right,"
Grandpop says, although he isn't. He'd like to have about 6 of the painkillers his sister no doubt has from her oncologist, but Nan is 100 miles from here, and he doesn't think they'll be seeing her today. No, not today.
"Drive."
"Did you really have that money, Grandpop?" Billy asks, as his mother starts back the way they came, going much faster than Frank dared to, wanting to put the slide in behind them. And slide in road, that too.
"Course not,"
Grandpop says. He wipes tears from his granddaughter's face and hugs her against him. It hurts, but he does it.
"Grandpop," she says, "you left Aunt Nan's special baseball bat."
"That's all right,"
Grandpop says, stroking her hair. It's all sweaty and tangled.
"Maybe we'll get it later."
Frank finally speaks. "We passed a little store on 196 just before we turned off. I'll call the police from there."
He turns and looks at the old man. There's a red mark on his cheek from the slap.
"This is your fault, Dad. It's all on you. We had to bring your fucking car, didn't we? If we'd had the Volvo..."
"Shut up, Frank," Corrine says. "Please,
just this once. And Frank does. Thinking of Flannery O'Connor. Red screen. Wilson is having a bad morning. He cuts himself shaving and is using a Kleenex to clean away a rill of blood on his chin when Sandy pops her head in to admonish him about leaving the toilet seat up and the cap off the toothpaste. He spills juice on his tie and has to change it. Before he can escape to work, there are several more admonishments. She found beer bottles in the trash instead of the recycling, and he forgot to rinse his ice cream bowl before putting it in the dishwasher. There's another one, but it goes in one ear and out the other without catching on anything in between. Kind of a bummer, all in all. Has he become forgetful and a little slipshod lately, or has she gotten more prickly in the last 6 or 8 months? He doesn't know, and it's too early for such questions. Yet once in the car and backing down the driveway, he has an idea that elevates his mood. If there's such a thing as bad karma, he may have front-loaded his for the day, and from here on, clear sailing, he exclaims, and treats himself to a cigarette out of the pack in the glove compartment. This optimistic idea holds for 15 minutes. Then he gets a call redirecting him to 34th Avenue in Queens. He is told to see the officers, which is never good karma. 5 hours later, when he should be thinking about lunch, Wilson is instead looking through one-way glass into a small interview room. There's a table and two chairs. In one of the chairs sits a man named Leonard Crocker. He's handcuffed to a ring bolt on his side of the table. He's wearing a strap-style undershirt on top of khaki work pants. His outer shirt is now in a tagged plastic bag and bound for forensics. When its turn comes, it will be a while because there's always a backlog. The blood stains on it will be typed and DNA matched. This is a formality. Crocker has already confessed to the murder. Soon his undershirt and khakis will be swapped for jailhouse tans. Wilson puts on his ID lanyard. When he goes into the room, he also puts on a smile. "Hi, Mr. Crocker. Remember me?" Leonard Crocker seems perfectly at ease, handcuffs and all. "You're the detective."
"Right."
Wilson sits down. "Do you answer to Len, Lenny, or Leonard?" "Lenny, mostly. That's what the guys down at the plumbing shop call me."
"Lenny it is, then. What we're having here, if you agree, is just sort of a preliminary conversation. You were given your rights, correct?"
Lenny smiles, as a man does when seeing through a trick question. "First by the officers at the scene, then by you. I called them, you know, the officers."
"Great.
Just to recap, anything you say can be used against me." Wilson's smile widens into a grin.
"Bingo.
What about legal representation? How's your memory on that? Because we're being recorded, you know."
"I can have a lawyer at any time. If I can't afford one, you'll get me one. It's the law."
"Correctamundo. So do you want one? Just say the word,
and I can get some lunch," Wilson thinks.
"I'm happy to talk to you, detective, but I'll need a lawyer at the trial, right?"
"Unless you want to defend yourself, but a man who defends himself..."
Lenny raises a finger and cocks his head, more the gesture of a scholar than a plumber. "Has a fool for a client."
Wilson laughs and nods. "Give the man a Cupid doll."
Then he grows more serious, folding his hands under his chin and looking straight at Lenny. "Why don't we get right to the point? You killed your wife this morning, didn't you? Stabbed her 3 times in the stomach, after which she bled out. That's what you told the officers, right? And me." Lenny shakes his head. "If you'll recall, what I actually said was, I did it."
"Meaning you killed your wife, Arlene Crocker."
"She wasn't my wife." Wilson takes his notebook from the inside pocket of his jacket and consults it.
"Is it your wife, Arlene Crocker?"
"Not today. Not for the last year," he considers. "Maybe longer.
It's hard to be sure. Are you saying you killed a stranger? One who just happens to look like your wife of 9 years?
Yes.
Linnea is looking at Wilson patiently, his face saying, eventually you'll get to the right questions, but I'm not going to help you.
So, when we type and DNA test the blood on your kitchen floor and all over your shirt, it won't match that of the deceased woman?
Oh, it probably will. Linnea gives a judicious nod. I'm almost sure it will, although I hope your science people will look for peculiar... He searches for the right word. Peculiar components. I don't think you'll find any, but it would be wise to check. I expect to go to jail for killing that thing, but I'd certainly prefer not to. Now, Wilson understands. Crocker has already got an insanity plea on his radar.
What are you telling me, Lenny? That your wife was possessed?
Help me understand. Lenny thinks it over.
I don't think you could call it that exactly. When a person is possessed, correct me if I'm wrong, detective, a spirit, or maybe a demon, comes in and takes over. But that person is still there, inside, being held prisoner. Is that your understanding?
Wilson has seen The Exorcist in a couple of similar movies, so he nods.
Pretty much. But that isn't what happened to your wife?
No. She died when it came in. They all do.
They all? Who all?
Not many, so far. Compared to the population of the Earth, which is now 8 billion, you can Google it, but there's more of them all the time. They take over, detective. It's the perfect disguise. We're the perfect disguise. Wilson pretends to think this over. What he's really thinking is this interview will be useless to the district attorney. There's going to be plenty of rigmarole ahead. A couple of prosecution psychiatrists, plus Crocker's own shrink. Wilson wouldn't be surprised if Crocker already had one on speed dial.
Aliens?
Crocker's face says the penny drops.
That's right. Aliens. I don't know if they come from space or from some parallel world. The websites are pretty much split on that.
I think space. It makes sense because, he leans forward, earnest. The speed of light, you know.
But what about it?
Not that Wilson cares. He's losing interest. What interests him is a ham and turkey club from the deli down the street and a Marlboro chaser.
Spaceships can't exceed it, or they go backwards in time, or maybe just disintegrate. That's the science. But pure mind, detective, that can make the jump. Only once they get here, they need bodies. Would probably die without them. We're in the preliminary stage of the invasion now. But if the world governments don't wise up, they'll be coming in thousands, hundreds of thousands. Millions.
Crocker has been leaning forward over his cuffed and chained hands, but now he sits back.
It's all on the internet.
I bet it is, Lenny. I bet Kamala Harris is one of those invaders, just waiting for Amtrak Joe to croak so she can get her hands on the levers of power.
He gets up.
I think you need to go back to your cell and think this over before you get arraigned. And just my advice, I think you need a good lawyer, because only a good one could sell that to a jury.
Sit down, Lenny says quietly. You'll want to hear this.
Wilson looks at his watch and decides to give Leonard Crocker 5 more minutes, possibly even 10. Maybe he can decide if the man is really crazy or trying to play him. He should be able to do that. He's a detective, after all.
5 or 6 years ago, someone figured out what's going on. It's on the dark web, detective, and spreading up from there, like ink. In water.
I'm sure it is. Wilson is no longer smiling. Along with blood-drinking Democrats, Clorox enemas to cure COVID, animal crush videos, and kiddie porn. You killed your wife, Lenny. You need to cut the shit and think about that a little. You stabbed her with a butcher knife and watched her die.
They change.
they become short-tempered and critical. They're not content with just being here. They want to dominate. But we have a chance, because some computer wizard figured out a way to detect him. If we survive, there'll be a statue of him in every country all over the world. The aliens trigger a deep command, okay? Automatic. Foolproof. Only a few people know about it now, but the information is spreading. That's what the internet's good for, spreading information. Not to mention mental illness, Wilson thinks. It's going to be a race. Lenny's eyes are wide. A race against time.
Whoa, rewind, okay? You killed your wife because she got short-tempered and critical?
Lenny smiles. Don't be dense, detective. Many women nag. I know that. So do men. It's easy to dismiss the preliminary indications.
He spreads his hands as far as the cuffs will allow, which isn't very far. Wilson says, I think that married to you, Arlene had a lot to be short-tempered and critical about.
She started picking, Lenny says. Picking and picking and picking. At first, I just felt depressed.
Old self-image took a hit, did it?
And then I became suspicious.
My own wife does some picking, Wilson says. Likes to tell me my car is a traveling pig pen. Gets pissy if I forget to put down a toilet seat. But I'm a long way from using a butcher knife on her.
I got the red screen. It's only for a second or two, so they won't see. But when I saw it, I knew.
But what I know is this interview is over. Wilson turns to the mirror on the wall to his left and runs the side of his hand across his throat. Cut it.
It's subtle, Lenny says.
He's giving Wilson a look that's both pitying and superior. Like that story about how you boil a frog by turning up the heat very slowly. They take from you. They take your self-respect. And when you're weak, he jerks his hands upward to the length of the chain and makes a choking gesture.
They take your life.
Women, right?
Women or men.
It's not a sexist thing. Don't get that idea. Not the exorcists, but the invasion of the body snatchers.
The wife killer breaks into a wide grin. Exactly.
You stick to that, Lenny. See how it works out for you.
Wilson gets home at 7:15.
Sandy's in the living room watching the evening news. One place is set at the kitchen table. It looks lonely. Hey, babe, he calls. Your dinner's in the oven. The chicken's probably dried out. You said you'd be home by 5. Things came up. They always do with you.
Did he tell Sandy he'd be home by 5? Wilson honestly can't remember. But he remembers Crocker, probably now cooling his heels in metropolitan detention, saying, it's subtle. He gets chicken and potatoes out of the oven and green beans out of the steamer on the stove. He thinks the potatoes will be okay, but the chicken and beans look elderly and unappetizing.
Did you pick up the dry cleaning?
He pauses, a slice of chicken breast half cut. Half sawn, actually.
What dry cleaning? She gets up and stands in the doorway. Our dry cleaning. I told you last night, Frank, Jesus.
His phone rings. He pulls it off his belt and looks at the screen. If the call was from his partner, he would decline. But it's not. It's from Captain Alvarez. I have to take this.
Of course you do, she says, and turns back to the living room so as not to miss the latest coronavirus death count. Honest to God.
He thinks of going after her, trying to smooth this over. But it's his boss, so he pushes accept. He listens to what Alvarez has to say, then sits down.
Are you shitting me?
How?
His voice brings Sandy back into the doorway. His slumped posture, phone to ear, head bent, one forearm resting on his thigh, brings her to the table. Wilson listens some more, then hangs up. He takes his plate to the sink and dumps everything into the garbage disposer. The perfect fucking end to a perfect fucking day.
What happened? Sandy puts a hand on his arm. Her touch is light, but very welcome to him.
We had a guy in custody who killed his wife. I was at the scene, a real mess. Blood all over the kitchen, her lying in it. Back at the station, I did the preliminary interrogation. The doer was crazy as a loon. He claimed she was an alien, part of an invasion force.
Oh my God.
He killed himself. We were doing intake at MetDed. He picked up a pencil, snapped the chain it was on, and stabbed himself in the jugular vein. Alvarez says maybe it was dumb luck, but the intake sergeant says it looked like he knew right where to put it.
Maybe he had medical training.
Sandy, he was a plumber.
That makes her laugh, which makes Wilson laugh.
He puts his forehead against hers.
It's not funny, Sandy says, but the way you said it was. Plumber!